This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Many people think the American Civil War had to happen. It reunited a divided nation and put an end to slavery. But UNC Charlotte professor David Goldfield sees things differently. He's not sure the war was necessary, and even if it was, he says it wasn't good. He calls a good war one in which the good outweighs the bad, and by that criteria, he says, the Civil War fails. UNC Chapel Hill professor Fitzhugh Brundage isn't certain, but he says it's essential that we ask the question. As part of our series, North Carolina Voices Civil War, we're talking today about the morality of the Civil War. Was it a good war, and does such a thing even exist? David Goldfield is Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at UNC Charlotte. He's also author of the book, America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. And he joins us now from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you, Frank.
Good to have you. And Fitzhugh Brundage, William Umstead, Distinguished Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill, joining us in the studio. Welcome back, Fitz.
Glad to be here and good to talk to you again, David.
David, you argue that the Civil War wasn't necessarily a good war. Why not?
Because 620,000 men died, and millions more at home mourned their loss, and many of the men came home maimed in mind and body. In fact, we had our first treatise on what we call today post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, written in 1876, and it dealt specifically with Civil War veterans. Certainly, there were two major results coming out of the Civil War. One was the liberation of 4 million slaves, and the other was the salvation of the Union. The question I ask, and I hope the questions that readers will ask when they read the book, is, first of all, was this war necessary to have those objectives fulfilled? And secondly, were those objectives and results of the war as much as they're trumped up to be? I would argue that for nearly a century after the war, African Americans had freedom, of course, but they did not have any of the fruits of that freedom. In fact, in 1888, on the 25th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, Frederick Douglass, the great black abolitionist, had a speech where he called the Emancipation Proclamation a fraud. Now, in the context of that particular time, it was understandable how Frederick Douglass viewed it in that way. Millions of African Americans still were toiling in the fields. Many were toiling with unrequited labor. And in terms of civil and political rights, they were really, really very scant as far as African Americans were concerned. So one of the questions that readers may pose is, was there a better way to achieve the liberation of 4 million blacks? With that better way, perhaps they would have achieved full citizenship much sooner. Now, the other part of the good war was that the Union was saved. Of course, the question arises, if there was no war, would the Union be destroyed? Well, it would have been a different Union, certainly. But given the economic development of the North in the 1840s and the 1850s, it was evident that the North would become almost synonymous with America in terms of industrialization and urbanization. And as a result, it would have been the economic juggernaut that it became. And in fact, for nearly a century again after the Civil War, when you talked about American ingenuity, American invention, and the American economy, you were essentially talking about the American North. So on balance, I would say that the Civil War was not a good war. It was a war of choice, not of necessity. It might have been better off, and this is, of course, sheer speculation on my part, anyone else's, it might have been better if we had solved the situation, or we could have solved the situation peacefully.
Well, let's talk about that. What would be the peaceful solution, particularly when it came to slavery? It was pretty clear that plantation owners were not going to give up that privilege of free labor, short of violence. No?
We don't know. I mean, as Fitz will tell you, as any historian will tell you, there's a lot of contingency in history. Things don't necessarily happen in rank order. 25 years ago, I Millions of people around the world said, well, the Berlin Wall will not come down in our lifetimes, and here it is, the Berlin Wall came down. So I think we have to look at the contingency of it. And one possible scenario, Frank, is that if the seven states that seceded in the wake of – in the months after Abraham Lincoln's election in November of 1860 – if there had not been a war, it is extremely unlikely whether North Carolina, Virginia, and some of the other so-called Upper South states would have seceded. So you would have had a confederacy of seven deep South states. And I would argue that it would have been very difficult to sustain that new nation for several reasons. First, slavery required expansion in order to thrive because cotton was a type of crop that really leached the soil tremendously. Where were they going to expand? They couldn't expand into the territories because that was a cardinal principle of Republican philosophy. They certainly couldn't expand into Mexico. The Mexicans wanted no part of them. And what foreign power would finance a new country, a slaveholding country? So this would have been very difficult to sustain this seven-state confederacy, and also the slaves within these seven states suddenly would find themselves in border states, and they could just go over the line and be in the United States. I would find it very difficult to believe that slavery could be sustained in the upper in a union of the Upper South. I think these states would have been more formally integrated into the American economy and in the American culture, as opposed to these seven seceding states. So eventually, I think the issue of slavery could have been solved. Now, the counter argument is, of course, that well, one extra day in slavery is one day too many. But again, consider the fact of the lives of the average African American in the South in the century after the Civil War, and while not necessarily slavery, I mean, Douglas Blackman calls it the re-enslavement of African Americans after the Civil War in a fine book that he wrote. But for this century, it might have been a different scenario had the situation been settled peacefully.
Settled peacefully, maybe a more sustainable solution, and maybe civil rights may have come sooner. You're suggesting, Fitzhugh Brundage, was the Civil War a good war? What's your definition, let's start there, of a good war?
It puts me in a difficult position of having to come up with a definition for something that I have a hard time knowing whether it exists. But there of course, are theological definitions of just wars, and there are legal definitions. I think of it as a kind of commonsensical vernacular idea of a war in which the outcome is commensurate with the costs of the war for the societies that waged them or for the society that waged it. So if the outcome produces a more just, fairer, civil society than existed before the war at a modest cost of life, then perhaps one can imagine a good war. Like David, I am perhaps not – I'm not quite as convinced that the Civil War was not a good war. I'm more ambivalent on that question, but this is a matter of shading. I think David makes a very, very persuasive argument on all of those points that he's mentioned. The one – area where I'm a little more equivocal has to do with the outcome of the Civil War. And the major thing that comes out of the Civil War with regards to race, it seems to me, in America are the three constitutional amendments, the so-called Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, which abolishes slavery, the 14th, which establishes a rudimentary definition of national citizenship rights, and then the 15th Amendment, which theoretically guarantees the right to vote. And David can make a very persuasive argument that none of these constitutional amendments were, with exception of the 13th Amendment, were really acknowledged and profoundly shaped the lives of Americans during the late 19th and early 20th century. And yet the point that I would make is, in none of the other slaveholding societies of the free world did the former slaves have, at least on record in the Constitution, guaranteed rights which they could use as leverage over the next century as they aspired for greater rights and greater opportunity to participate. So there is one outcome other than the end of slavery that's important, I think, and that is that the Constitution was changed in a way that created openings for greater rights to be secured in the future. Now, all of that is I then immediately jump back and concede everything that David said about how limited were the practical, tangible, day-to-day gains as a result of the Civil War.
Tell you what, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the Civil War was viewed at the time, the moral arguments for Civil War, against it, and the moral arguments on both sides of that war. We'll continue that conversation with David Goldfield. He's with us. He's the Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and also Fitzhugh Brundage is with us. He's a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Part of our North Carolina Voices series, The Civil War, continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking about the morality of the Civil War with David Goldfield. He is Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at UNC Charlotte and author of America Aflame: How the Civil War Created a Nation. Fitzhugh Brundage is with us as well, William Umstead, Distinguished Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill. David, in your book, you talk about the religious underpinnings of the war. Tell us about that.
Evangelical Protestantism became a national religion of the sort in the sense that the Second Great Awakening generated a great many conversions to the evangelical Protestant denominations, primarily Methodists, Baptists, and Presbyterians. And the key element in this revival was the emphasis upon declaring your life for Jesus Christ. That is, if you believe Jesus Christ is your personal Savior, then you, in fact, will be saved. Many Northern evangelicals, however, took that one step further, and they believed that in order for Jesus Christ to come again, the second coming of Jesus Christ, that society as a whole, the sins of society would have to be expiated. And there were many problems, of course, in society, in prisons, child labor, and poverty. But the two greatest sins of America, according to Northern evangelicals at the time, were the Roman Catholic Church and slavery. And in the Republican Party in the 1850s, these two evangelical causes were married. I mean, we can talk a little later about why Roman Catholics were so dangerous for Northern evangelicals. But these two sins, as it were married in the Republican Party. And beginning in the Republican Party was founded in the mid-1850s, but as early as 1840, we began to have a Christian party, an evangelical Christian party, emerge in the political process, a third political party, a minor political party, dedicated to anti-slavery. And in the 1850s, as Irish immigration increased significantly, over 1 million Irish came between 1847 and 1858, a significant number considering the relatively small population of the United States at the time. There was great concern about the influence of Roman Catholics and the Roman Catholic Church. And so the Know-Nothing Party, the American Party, was born. And eventually that many members of that party merged into a new anti-slavery party, the Republican Party, and you have this merger, as I indicated, of anti-Catholic influence as well as anti-slavery tenets. And that entered the political process. And the problem with religion in the political process is that our government governs best from the center. Our government governs best through moderation and compromise. And when you have the intrusion of religion into the political process, unfortunately, you cannot compromise with sin. You can compromise on political issues and give and take. And if you look at the great pieces of legislation that have come out of our government over the past 100, 150 years, you can see they were the results of compromise. For example, the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. That legislation is not perfect. It rarely is in a Republican form of government. But that was hammered out with both Democrats and Republicans compromising on various points. And we have, I think, a positive result. But when you have both sides proclaiming that they are the righteous side and with certitude that they are on God's side, it really becomes very difficult to compromise because your opponent no longer becomes misinformed or misguided. Your opponent becomes evil. Your opponent is a bad person. So as the center erodes, as it becomes much more difficult to find that common ground, then you open the door for a much wider conflict to occur.
It seems to me,
and
though,
that's what happened.
Whether it's rooted in a particular sectarian religion or not, moral beliefs tend to be as fundamental as religion, aren't they? When you talk about something like slavery, it tends to be either right or wrong. We can't conscience this thing for another minute. If you're against it, and if you think it's in the Bible, I guess it's strictly religious. But isn't it moral? And doesn't a moral issue like that become very difficult to compromise over, whether it's rooted in your religion?
Well, the problem with morality, it really depends on who you are. And morality and your interpretation of the Bible in particular can be very, very different from one person to another. And that was the problem with William Seward's comment that there is a higher law than the Constitution. We are a nation of laws, and we should be governed by the Constitution, not by the Bible, for the simple reason that the Bible is open to many different interpretations. And if we go that route, we're going the route of chaos, and that will quickly topple the government or create a standstill, a gridlock.
Fitz, what's your sense of the role religion played in this conflict?
Well, I think as David's pointed out, the powerful influence of both a kind of pro-slavery and an anti-slavery theology leading up to the crisis that exploded in the Civil War. I think more broadly, I think of what happened with American churches before the Civil War as being similar to what happened with most American institutions. There was the Civil War is the result. Some people argue it's a kind of clash of civilizations, if you will. I've never found that terribly convincing. Instead, it seems to me it's the result of a crisis, the failure of American institutions to bind together a very disparate republic that had been founded a decade after the American Revolution. And the crisis of American religion at the time of the Civil War was that it was a muddle in the sense that not only had many of the major Protestant denominations broken up into a pro-slavery Southern denomination and an anti-slavery Northern denomination, but theologically it was utterly chaotic and incoherent on, for example, the pressing issue of the day, be it slavery. And so to me, it's the failure of religious leaders to actually have spoken in a compelling way to help resolve this crisis. Now, I'm not talking about taking religion into the political realm so much as I am addressing even the religious questions about how to bind together a slave South and a free North.
What do you think about that, David? The idea that perhaps this was in part a failure of political institutions to really bring the nation together. And if that's true, do you think that the rise of religion essentially was a phenomenon that somehow was meant to address that?
Well, Fitz is absolutely correct in this. In fact, I say in the book that the Civil War is America's greatest failure. It was a failure because our political system broke down. As I mentioned, our political system depends upon this give and take, this compromise, this moderation. And once you inject this moralism, this certitude, this self-righteousness, this evangelical religion into the political process and into specific issues, compromise becomes much, much less likely.
You think that's still alive in American politics today?
Oh, I think it's very much alive in American politics today. I think the gridlock that we're seeing in our government today is a reflection of that, not only from a religious perspective and a religious intrusion into the government. I think these social issues, these cultural issues are still very salient, like abortion and gay rights and school prayer and those issues, for example. But I think also we're seeing the erosion of the center, this movement to the extremes. And this demonization of our opponents is not merely being misinformed, but also being just bad people. This one saving grace, though, Frank, I think, as opposed to what occurred in 1860 and 1861, the one saving grace today is that in 1860 and 61, we had a very close to 80% of the voting population voted. And you're never going to get that percentage today. It's unlikely, let's put it that way. And almost every one of those individuals closely tied to a political party. Today, we have close to 40% of our electorate identified as independents. And independent voters historically have been centrist. That is, they tend to move the political process toward the center. So I don't see our country flying apart as we did in 1861. It's just that the politicians now need to be chastened by these independent voters, and that probably will happen in 2012.
You were talking today about whether the Civil War was a good war, trying to define that, talking about whether we could ever find something like a good war and how to define it. Maybe one way to look at that, Fitz, is to see how the Civil War has been remembered through time. If we go back to the 50th anniversary, the 100th, and now we're at the 150th, how has that changed over time?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and it also provides me an opportunity to put David's book into that longer story, which I think is important to do. As we can well imagine, after the Civil War, the immediate task was to somehow bind together a nation that had just waged an incredibly gruesome, extended, painful, bloody war. And so the predominant struggle of the late 19th century over the meaning of the Civil War was, shall we say, a struggle to find grounds for reconciliation. And by the early 20th century, those grounds had been found, and there was a broad consensus that the Civil War had been fought between two different groups of Americans who had two different understandings of what the American Republic was about, that they had fought valiantly on behalf of their two different visions, and that all things considered, the outcome of the war was good because slavery had been destroyed, which was not bad because of what it had done to African Americans, but it had somehow stunted the South. It had held up the development of the nation. And that with the victory of the North in the Civil War, sectionalism and secession had been finally stamped out for good. So then the United States could progress into becoming a world power. Well, that general argument prevailed. That was the common wisdom up until the 1930s. And then for a brief moment, there was almost a generation of historians who looked upon the Civil War as an unnecessary war, a tragic war. And they saw it in some of the ways in which David has been talking about, I've been suggesting, in some ways about the failures of American institutions. But they tended to downplay the horrors of slavery and to dismiss them. And then after World War II, after the experience of seeing Nazism, after the emergence of a modern civil rights movement, historians took a very different view and tended to see the Civil War, and have tended to see the Civil War in the last 50 years as being, broadly speaking, a development that was necessary to eradicate slavery, not just because somehow that held back the United States, but because slavery was an immoral institution. So all of this, coming back to I think what David has done with this book that is so very important, is he has revived, if you will, a discussion that has more or less not been held for more than a generation, probably two generations, about whether the Civil War was the best way to accomplish some of the things that we recognize now as having been vital, namely the destruction of slavery. So that's a very important question that we just, on the whole, historians have not engaged for almost 60, 70 years.
David, if that's true, why is that an important question? Why should we even be talking about this?
Because how we remember history is very important in how we live in the present and how public policy is shaped for our future. As Fitz noted, after the Civil War, the emphasis was upon reconciliation. Both sides, there was a moral equivalency to both sides. And in this aura of reconciliation, it was much more likely and much more possible to ignore the very real problems, the very real issues of African-American equality, of labor equality, of gender equality, of immigrants. As a result, the emphasis was upon reconciliation. Well, let's not rock the boat. Let's not deal with these other issues. The important thing is bringing our nation together, binding up the wounds, as Abraham Lincoln indicated. So if we view that slavery was, well, sort of a minor issue, or that it really wasn't slavery really wasn't that bad, then maybe Jim Crow is not that bad either. And maybe African Americans really like to live under Jim Crow. So how we view history really has a tremendous impact on how we view ourselves and how public policy is shaped. So this is extremely important. And I think, Fitz articulated this very well. The prevailing view made me uncomfortable, this idea that, A, slavery caused the Civil War, secondly, the Civil War was a war of liberation, and third, that Reconstruction was a failure. Those are the three pillars of the current historiography on the Civil War. Now, there's nothing wrong with that view, but I would hold, and my book indicates that these views are incomplete. Sure, without slavery, there would not have been a Civil War, but why did slavery cause a Civil War in 1861? After all, slavery had existed throughout our nation's history. And secondly, if you look upon the Civil War as a war of liberation, let's look at what happened after the war. And let's look what the Union soldiers, for example, felt about this idea of liberation as far as African Americans were concerned. And finally, looking upon Reconstruction as a failure, I think, is wrong, because if you use the word failure, the implication is that it had some chance of succeeding. But if you look at the racial attitudes of the vast majority of Northerners, if you read their letters, if you read their newspapers, and of course the vast majority of white Southerners as well, you could see that they were not about to give up equal rights to African Americans. They genuinely believed that black people were inferior. And in this context, it would really have been unlikely had the promise of Reconstruction been fulfilled.
Fitz, we're talking mostly about the Civil War. Are there other wars that we debate? Are there other wars that you would consider a good war in American history?
Before I tackle that, or try to tackle that, let me just jump back and piggyback on something David just said. I think one of the lessons that I would draw from the Civil War that's important for us to remember is it should chasten us about the capacity of humans to ever control a war. The most significant consequence of the Civil War was an unintended consequence of the white participants in that war. We certainly know white Southerners never went into the Civil War anticipating that they would lose their slaves. And we know that white Northerners did not go into the war on the assumption, most white Northerners did not go into the war on the assumption that slaves would be liberated. It's only slaves who took advantage of the circumstances of the Civil War to partially liberate themselves and also create momentum, pressure, that would compel Lincoln to liberate them through the Emancipation Proclamation. So in other words, the most important outcome of the Civil War was not intended, and one could imagine all sorts of circumstances that might have happened that could have brought the war to a close sooner, in which case the emancipation of slaves might have been far less than what came about later in the war and by the end of the war. So all of this is to say, this is building on David's point there, when we think about the Civil War, instead of working on the assumptions that there are certain outcomes that were inevitable, once Fort Sumter's fired upon, then we know what happened and those outcomes were inevitable. Instead, I think the contingencies are so important in understanding the way that this war unfolded. And if we pay attention to those contingencies, then I think we'll be chastened about our ability to control what wars do and the outcomes they produce. As far as your question about are there other wars that are good wars, you know, I jokingly tell people I'm a secular Calvinist, and so I tend to see the darkest in the human soul. And so I have a very hard time finding examples, unambiguous examples of a good war.
Well, I would give you time for that, David, if I had to respond as well, but I don't. And I appreciate talking with both of you today on the program. Fitzhugh Brundage, William Umstead, Distinguished Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill. David Goldfield is Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at UNC Charlotte. He's the author of the book, America Aflame: How the Civil War Created a Nation, and he joined us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Fitz and David, thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, a burn victim hosts a benefit for the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center that features the music of the Willie Painter Band live on the State of Things in just a minute. Stay tuned.